The newest Ken Burns film, Country Music, will air this fall on PBS. Ken Burns is currently out on a bus tour with producer and writer Dayton Duncan, producer Julie Dunphy, and Old Crow Medicine Show's Ketch Secor. I caught up with all four of them earlier this week in Knoxville to talk about country music. First of all, welcome to East Tennessee. It's great to have you all here.
Thank you. That's very kind.
Can you speak a little bit about East Tennessee, its importance in country music, bluegrass music?
There's probably no region in the United States that's contributed more to the development of country music than East Tennessee, or another way to call it would be the Southern Highlands. The mountains that stretch through here and that also mean Kentucky and parts of Southwest Virginia, North Carolina. This is where it all came bubbling up.
And how did you get at Ketch? How did you get involved with this project? I know you have some roots actually in East Tennessee as well.
I lived here for some time in my life. My parents lived here in Knoxville. But I was involved because they were looking for somebody who could talk about some of the origins of country music and play some fiddle in the movie. And it's been a thrill to be a part of it.
When you did the jazz documentary, which must have felt like an impossible task, I mean, it's such an important art form and it's so big and there's so many tangents. Did you learn anything from doing that that helped you do country music, which is just as big?
Well, I don't think I learned anything that was directly applicable, except that I learned a little bit about music is traditionally background in films, and in jazz we learned that it was going to be middle ground and foreground and sometimes hyperground as we deconstructed things. And so it prepared me for some of the just wonderful moments that this film was going to have. I think the biggest thing is that how similar they are. And I think that we've, you know, imprisoned them with the label, and that you see in the history of jazz, and you see then in the history of country music, the free flow of stuff. I mean, it isn't just Louis Armstrong recording Blue Yodel Number 9 standing on the corner with Jimmy Rogers. It's all the things. It's the fact that blues seems to be an elemental part of all of American music, and that it has affected positively the most important people in country music. So there's great relationships. In fact, we needed Wynton to help us interpret this because he understood, as we did other musicians from other disciplines, Elvis Costello and Jack White, you know, and by extension, historically, the Beatles and many other people who come through, Paul Simon, who help us sort of help to find and center and place country music within the context of other things, because we tend to, you know, keep it in its lane. You know, that's a new thing. You know, you've gotten outside your lane. Like, what does that mean? And musicians don't see that. Chet Atkins from East Tennessee was as influenced by Django Reinhardt as anybody. Willie Nelson from Texas is as influenced by Django Reinhardt, a jazz guitarist, as anybody. His phrasings are all jazz. So Willie can't be in, Chet can't be in, or all of a sudden is everybody in everywhere? Charlie Parker, which we said, the one overlap in this story, besides Wynton's presence, is Charlie Parker's story, which Marty Stewart relates in our country music film, and which the late jazz critic Nan Hentoff related in our jazz series, which was in the heyday of bebop, just after the Second World War on 52nd Street in New York. Charlie Parker is playing the music that he invented, not dissimilar to the music that Bill Monroe invented, called bluegrass, that is to say fast-paced virtuosity that's blowing everybody's mind. And in between sets, he's feeding the jukebox. And what is he playing but Hank Williams? And the rest of the cats in the set are going, you know, man, what are you doing? He goes, listen to the stories. So what we found in all the films we've done, whether it was jazz or this or Civil War or Vietnam, is we just listen to the stories. And there. And in country music, they're clean as a whistle. They're clear as a bell. They're direct and elemental in their information. They carry kind of the DNA of us, that is to say, human experience.
And you're talking about staying in your lane, which is, I'm really glad you brought that up, because Charlie Pride gets a nice section in this. And Wynton Marsalis says something to the effect of, the art tells more of the
Thank
tale
you.
Of us coming together.
Okay, you're a smart guy. You don't need to interview us anymore. You got it. That's what it's all about. That art tells more of the tale of us coming together. That's it. That's the reason why we do any of these things. The reason why we tell stories is that we're able to like suddenly take the apparent divisions or the lanes or the silos or the labels or whatever the pejorative pigeonhole that we want to say, and realize that there are people among us who obliterate those barriers. And that country music is about that, jazz is about that. So many things that we've done are about that. And the art tells the tale of us coming together. That all of the, and look at the picture that we're showing at that moment. Two black musicians and a little white boy sticking his head around the corner, stealing a peek. It's the curiosity about the other rather than what we inculcate in everybody, which is the fear of the other, the otherness of the other. So the art tells the tale. You got it.
Well, that's the end. Thank you very
much. Yeah, no.
Don't watch it. You just heard it. No, you must watch it. And I grew up in Knoxville, huge country music fan. And I absolutely love it. And the Charlie Pride section, coming back to that one. Was it easier for him to break into country music than it was for Jackie Robinson to break into baseball?
What a great question. What a great question. And I don't want to monopolize, but having... I've done baseball and Jackie Robinson and...
I will only say this chronologically and let Ken answer it more deeply, is what was interesting to me about Charlie's interview in his life is he's a sharecropper, son of a sharecropper, dreaming these big dreams of doing something, anything else but picking cotton, you know, in the Mississippi Delta. And Jackie Robinson breaks the baseball color barrier, and he thinks, his first instinct is, that's my way out. So, you know, whether one was easier than the other, I don't know, but one preceded the other and influenced Charlie. And so he developed that skill. But meanwhile, he also had a voice that's, you know, unmatched, and had this other skill as well.
No, I don't think I would bring any kind of just experiential qualification, but I do think it's really important to note, because all of us have white skin and have the luxury of not having to actually think almost continually that we have white skin, that Chris Rock, the comedian, said to mostly white college audiences, I'm a multimillionaire and none of you would trade positions with me for a second. And that is true for Jackie Robinson at that moment. It was true Charlie Pride, and admittedly, it's a little bit farther along down the line. There's been the Brown versus Board of Education, Dr. King has come along. There's been a Civil Rights Act that's passed. There's Voting Rights Act that's being passed at the time that he's coming up. We're beginning to do this, but we're right back into places where, at the highest levels, we're tolerating the segregation and the judging of people based on the color of their skin. So and we're losing people. We're finding, which has always been happening, people are dying. We just happen to have these things that can record it, so we think there's some uptick in it, but there have been missing human beings all along. So Charlie Pride has a tough row to hoe, and he's got, because of his last name and his daddy, a certain kind of energy and ability to dream that's going to allow him to push optimistically through in a way not dissimilar to Dolly's sort of, you know what, I'm going to do this. And if Farron Young's going to be a problem, let's go see Farron Young right away. You know, not like let's just wait and hopefully we don't bump into him, which might be my inclination. You know, but he's got something to confront it. And Chris Rock obviously has transcended the limited circumstances of being a black man in America, or the limiting circumstances, to do something. But, you know, one of the things that we've found over and over again in all our films, and we're thrilled to say it's part of country music as well, is just, as Catch calls it in episode one, the rub. That's the title of episode one. And what the rub is the friction between the banjo, symbolically between the banjo and the fiddle. It's the friction between white and black. It's the good stuff. I mean, we normally detail, as I've just done, all the negative stuff. But in the case of country music, in the case of American music, that friction has just gone a lot of ways to permit those artists to tell us the secret that they know. And so I'm not sure I would say one had it better than the other. It's just, it's really tough to be black in the United States.
it's not always a picnic being a woman in the United States either.
Unless you're in country music, in which case you are ruling.
Yeah, if you can write a song that everyone's against, but then it makes money, kind of like with the Outlaws as well. But this brings me to Loretta Lynn, who I've always loved, and watching this documentary made me not only love her, but admire her, because she's called a radical.
Yeah.
Can you speak to how Loretta Lynn is a radical?
Well, I have my favorite story about Loretta Lynn and more people understanding Loretta Lynn. We showed episode 5 last summer at a college in New Hampshire, and it was the first time we were really letting a general audience see it, and a friend of mine brought his 17-year-old daughter because his wife couldn't come, and the 17-year-old daughter had no interest. She just really didn't want to be there. She wasn't interested in country music, and I got an email the next morning saying she got home and downloaded every Loretta Lynn song she could find and started sharing, you know, with her friends. So to me, that spoke volumes about, you know, here's somebody, a young woman 50 years later, however many years later, getting the pill and don't come home a drinking, and all that Loretta was saying at a time when other musicians in other genres were not saying those kind of things.
No, don't come home a drinking with loving on your mind. Just stay out there on the town and see what you can find. 'Cause if you want that kind of love, well, you don't need none of mine. So don't come home a drinking with loving on your mind.
And even as a songwriter, I think that there's this one moment where she mystifies Jack White, because he's not really understanding the context.
Last night got drunk, right. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Her brain's just it's 3 steps ahead of him.
Yeah, yeah. I think with her, and I think with a number of other artists, as a writer myself, I'm interested in the writing process. And songs are, you know, these are poetry with music to them. And I wanted to make sure that we gave attention to who wrote that song and what was behind that song. But there are a number of them, and Loretta is one example, I think, of many in our film, where we try to get beyond what you thought about that person as a performer and give them the credit that they're due. And Loretta is certainly one of those that Jack, if you get Jack White and Elvis Costello, baffled by what an unbelievable, and Vince Gill, what an incredible songwriter she actually is, reminding you to make you listen to those lyrics and make you understand the context of it. And you have to say, they're absolutely right. These other artists see something that maybe in the shine and shimmer of celebrity that we overlook. And Dolly Parton is similarly one of those people where we have different ones who are just in awe of her because of her talent to write a song, you know, both the lyrics and the music.
I think this documentary will let her reclaim "I Will Always Love You," because
question about it. I just said that the other an hour or two ago. Like Whitney Houston, that version is fantastic, but when you get the context of this, Dolly just somehow was like the tortoise. She just passed the, you know, it's like really just it. She overtook a great, great thing. You know, I don't think Kris Kristofferson's version of "Me and Bobby McGee" is ever going to match Janis Joplin. So this isn't just across the board truth, but it's
in this case.
In this case, I'm as blown away, I think, as you are by that.
My favorite things in the documentary is it fails to answer the question, where do songs come from? Where does this magic come from? Ketch, I mean, as a songwriter yourself, do you have any ideas about this? And did that resonate with you? All these people going, I don't know where it comes from. It just comes.
One of the principal characters in country music, and thus in this film, country music, is Merle Haggard. And Merle has almost godlike presence in the film, and I so appreciate that the filmmakers chose to put him, to cast him this way, because I think that he has had this role for, you know, they asked him one time about what was it like to spend, you know, 40 years in the music business, and he said he'd signed up for a 40-year bus ride. And it's the thing about this, the way the life of it is, that makes the song so rich. But it's they don't happen at the same time. It's I just love how his portrayal in the film of, he's always popping up when you need to check in with the great spirit.
So right.
That's where right. The songs are.
That's where they are.
They're up there.
He says that, the dreams and souls. And I think that's a pretty good market. See. And then things you can't see. And then Marty Stewart talks about
circle of words.
Circle of words. Marty Stewart, I don't know if it's in the thing that you've seen, he kind of explains it that somebody asked Hank Williams how the songs, he says, he just, you know, puts them up and let God give them to you. And he says, so if you're collaborating with the creator of the moon and the stars and all of this stuff, the mountains, writing a 2.5-minute country song can't be that big deal. You know, I mean, I've butchered the paraphrase, but that's what it is about. It's sort of finding that place where everything is one and be able to reflect experiences that are common to everybody. And you can just hear, you know, Brenda Lee is talking about Hank's, you know, "I'm so lonesome I can cry." He says, "If you ever think of a bird too blue to fly?" You know, and all of a sudden you're taking, yeah, I know those lyrics. Everything's very elemental. But you go, of course. You know, that's what makes it a perfect song. Paul Simon's not in the film, but he dissected "Hey, Good Looking," and just the rhythm of the words and all of the car, one phrase after another, tripping down. You thought you were in an English class listening to somebody parse Yeats, and it's "Hey, Good Looking." How's about cooking something up with me? I got a
hot rod Ford and a $2 bill. He says, "A hot rod Ford and a $2 bill." I mean, you know, that's just such
a. And I know a place
right over the hill.
And just the perfection of that is exquisite, you know?
Well, I can't recommend this documentary highly enough. It's people that love country music, I feel, are going to love it more. And people that don't know about it are in for a treat. I love it.
No, but you just express what our
hope is.
Our hope.
Yes,
is
exactly. Exactly.
People who already love it will learn things that they might have either forgotten or never known, and people who know nothing about it or disparage it for whatever reason will find that they really do like it, because there's something there for everybody.
And further, the widening the spectrum of what it is,
yeah,
for everybody.
You know, it's a funny thing is that there's a kind of unspoken part of the narrative that the Nashville sound and later Countrypolitan was smoothing out its rough edges. It couldn't have been good. It had to have been that. It was all a mercantile excuse to sell more records to try to merge with pop. And there's a kind of just sort of patina of negativity about it. But some of the greatest tunes in the history of country music come out of that. And more people recommended the apotheosis of Countrypolitan Nashville sound, which is George Jones, "He Stopped Loving Her," today. You know, and more people said that was their favorite country song. Now, you'd think that the purists would say, oh, it's got to be this or it's got to be that. But that just tells you how ecumenical we can all be about music within country music and outside of it as well. Because there are places, I mean, we're just listening in Bristol in the museum to Willie doing "Will the Circle Be Unbroken." We're hearing 45 other people across the ages singing "Will the Circle Be Unbroken," all hitting more or less the same marks. Bonnie Raitt, you know, the Staples Singers, way back with the Carters, all of this. And Willie is running through every stop sign and stopping in the middle of every place where everyone else keeps going. And it's just so refreshing, you know? It's just great, so.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Will the circle be unbroken by my Lord, by? That's better.